When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to The High-Low, the weekly current affairs and pop culture podcast brought to you by Dolly Alderton and Pandora Sykes.
In tragic but somewhat inevitable news, Boris Johnson is officially Prime Minister, and in his acceptance speech, he used the word dude and said it dude.
I say to all the doubters, dude, we are going to energise the country.
That's a double whammy of shit there for everyone.
Let's not be too defeatist. Let's wait and see what happens before we ring the death knell. In other breaking news, I read a statistic in The Guardian, which I thought was pretty interesting. Apparently, we have fewer best friends in the UK than in any other country. 2.6 compared to Saudi Arabia's 6.6. But new research from MIT says it's impossible to have more than 5 close friends. What do you think of that?
I think it's completely dependent on the personality type and what kind of life you have. Because I know people who have literally 4 friends, like a handful of friends, and those are the only people that they see
And need.
And they're completely satisfied and content. And then I've got one friend in particular that I'm thinking of. Every weekend when I ask what she's doing, she never presents me with a name I'm familiar with. She must have 150 close friends. And I think she's happy. I don't think she's escaping anything.
I've got a friend like that.
Yeah, I think she just likes having lots and lots of different people in her life. So I really do think it's to do with how much space you have in your life and what your personality type is.
Interestingly, because she filed it before this news story came out, India Knight wrote her column on Sunday on the idea of collecting friends, something that I think is quite common in the digital age where the concept of a friend is quite flimsy. And she said it's better to have a few buttered toast friends, which I loved. I know exactly what she meant by that. But to quote Matthew McConaughey, I call bullshit on any stats about it, because as you say, what's right for one person is not right for another. And you can't put a quota on friendship, that I'm only allowed 2.6 friends. That's what I used to do when I was like 12. You were only ever allowed 3 best friends, and it was an agonising situation because you'd have to rotate someone in and then boot someone out. And I was booted at times via a note, and it still hurts.
Cabinet reshuffles. One of the worst insults that I've seen about me and my book online, which I wish I hadn't seen, because you know when you think that you've imagined all the worst things that could ever be said
about you, hadn't imagined this one.
And I hadn't imagined this one, and I saw 2 people talking about it, and I was like, oh great, there's a new one to obsess over. They were like, it seems to me like Dolly thinks that she's really popular and that she has loads of friends. And I was like, do I think that? And then I confided in my friend India about it last week while we were on holiday. I was like, do you think that I think I've got loads of friends? And she said, no, the opposite. I've actually always really worried whenever you write about your friends or talk about your friends that you look like a real loner because you only ever mention 4 names.
My friend India, my friend Farley.
Exactly.
Also this week, it was announced that computer scientist Alan Turing is to be the first gay man to be honoured on a banknote, the £50 note. The next Bond film will feature a black female 007, the actress Lashana Lynch, and Starbucks has released a tie-dye frappuccino.
Speaking of tie-dye, did you hear about Curry Siegel?
I did. I saw him too. He is arresting.
For anyone unfamiliar with the story, CNN reports, an exotic-looking bright orange bird was rescued by a wildlife hospital after people saw him on the side of a highway. It was unclear what was wrong with the feathery phoenix, and animal rescuers were not sure what to expect at first. According to Tiggy Winkles Hospital in Buckinghamshire, where it was taken, the bird had somehow doused himself in curry or turmeric, which prevented him from flying properly. Vinny, named by veterinary workers in honour of the vindaloo curry he was covered in, had a pungent smell but was otherwise healthy. All he needed was a bath. Now that he's been thoroughly scrubbed and returned to his natural white colouring, Vinny will soon be ready to fly free. Sorry, I just love when the high-low covers this stuff. This isn't the first time a seagull needed a good cleaning after taking a curry bath. In 2016, another seagull fell into a vat of chicken tikka masala as he tried to enjoy a meal.
It's good to know it's a trend. Also this week, Fleabag received a whopping 11 nominations at the Emmys.
Quite right.
And the Cats trailer is freaking out literally every single person that has watched it, including the whole of my Twitter. I thought I'd accidentally clicked on a moment on Twitter because all any journalist I follow was tweeting about was the Cats trailer. Have you seen it? What do you think?
Yes, I did see it, and it did make me feel a bit funny. I just got the feeling that something wasn't quite right.
Well, because they are... they're human-cat hybrid.
I don't like it.
Human faces, but then no, like, flat chests on women.
It's the furry face. I just didn't... it made me feel odd. And I actually love the score of that musical, and I loved all the actors in it. I don't know what... how did you watch it?
Yeah, I thought it was... I thought it was weird. It felt weird. I actually wasn't as perturbed as all of Twitter was.
Yeah, I still can't put my finger on why. I have to say I'm very happy that Judi Dench is in it, because for a very long time, my friend Tim has owned a British shorthair cat called Tina, who is the double of Judi Dench.
I liked her. She's got a really great sort of coat. She looks like Aslan.
Yeah, yeah. It was the role she was born to play, I think.
In more serious news, Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe has been moved back to jail from psychiatric hospital in Iran, where her husband Richard said she was chained to the bed. And it was revealed this week that despite Ireland's repeal of the Eighth Amendment last year, and despite this being mandated to come into effect on January the 1st, only 10 of the 19 maternity hospitals in Ireland currently offer the full legal abortion services due to conscientious objectors, some of whom, in the case of St Luke's Hospital in Kilkenny, are the hospital's obstetricians themselves. Thus, women are still being forced to travel at their own expense to procure what are now legal abortions. I had no idea about this. Until one of our Irish listeners tweeted us with this news story. And it's a reminder to us all that progress is slow. And to end on a rather lovely news story, to celebrate its 150th birthday, Sainsbury's supermarket in Bath was rebranded last week as Sainsbury's to raise awareness of hard of hearing people and help the public better communicate with them. 100 staff at Sainsbury's took part in British Sign Language lessons, and visual guides and smart tech was installed in store. Wouldn't it be great if this could occupy a more permanent place in supermarkets?
That's so brilliant. What a wonderful way to celebrate their anniversary. And as you say, I hope they're looking for a more long-term plan to make their supermarkets more accessible and safe and just welcoming for those who are hard of hearing.
What's in the mailbag this week?
We had lots of gushing emails about David Nicholls, including this very sweet one about a fan letter he replied to a few years ago. I wanted to drop you a quick note to share my limitless love for, as you rightly called him, our national sweetheart, David Nicholls. 5 years ago, when I was a teenager determined to write, having been greatly influenced by One Day, I wrote a fan letter to David Nicholls asking him for writing advice. To my utter shock, he replied with a letter stretching to over one whole page of typed A4, in small font, I might add, giving excellent advice about writing and life as a whole. I will never forget how happy that letter made me and how shocked I was that such a successful, celebrated author had taken the time to reply with such depth to a young fan, especially in a posted letter as opposed to a quick tweet.
That's incredible.
And also totally ratifies his nickname as Dreamy David Nicholls.
Oh, I'm very happy to hear that.
We had a couple of listeners ask for the website that I mentioned about the tech that's being developed, as they couldn't find it in the show notes. And that's because, I'm very sorry, it wasn't a website. It was, in fact, a PDF that my friend sent me. So I'll try and post that on the Hilo's Twitter account today.
A neuroscientist also wrote in with an interesting take on the "Are our phones listening to us?" debate and a suggestion for conducting an experiment. I, like many others, am so interested to know if apps do listen to us and advertise accordingly. However, I am yet to be convinced by anecdotes. An often proposed argument for why you see such targeted adverts after discussing certain topics within distance of your phone is that simply by talking about something, say it is a new pair of jeans, you are suddenly much more aware of adverts for jeans. The human brain is incredible at filtering out all kinds of information that doesn't seem relevant at the time, so much so that you may not remember ever seeing a Levi's advert on Facebook before you started thinking about jeans. I think that's very true. I can remember when I was pregnant and suddenly I saw pregnant women everywhere. She then suggested conditions for a controlled experiment. Firstly, pick a topic to talk about you can be fairly certain that you won't have Googled in the past, say, month. For example, where to buy the most sturdy car tyres when you don't own a car. Secondly, you need to check Facebook adverts a certain number of times a day, depending on how often you use it, for a week before you discuss the topic within listening distance of your phone's microphone. Record how often adverts about the topic come up. Then discuss with friends loudly and potentially at multiple times over two or so days. For the next week, check Facebook the exact same number of times and see if you are getting any or an increased number of adverts about your chosen topic. If you suddenly get a dramatic increase in these targeted ads, you are most likely being listened to. If not, you can rest easy knowing your phone acts like your brain, filtering out most of the information it gets during the day. Finally, you must not search for this topic on any device that you may be logged into Google on at all during the time before starting the experiment and the week you are checking for adverts after.
Interesting. I think that thoroughness is important. I should say I haven't done this randomly. My friend and I have done kind of controlled-ish experiments before with it, talking about a subject we've never talked about before over the course of weeks, every time we had our phones out. But I do appreciate what she's saying about how the human brain latches onto information and goes hunting for it without our awareness, really.
On a separate note, a reminder that should you wish to come and see the Hilo live in action, there are a few tickets remaining for the Hilo experience in Manchester in October. Dublin, London and Glasgow have now sold out and we cannot wait to see some of you there. To buy tickets to the Manchester show, go to faneproductions.com/Hilo. We will link that in the show notes. If you want to see Dolly cut me in half with an invisible sword, it is not one to miss. What have you been enjoying this week while you were sunning yourself in Greece, Dolly?
I read and adored Less by Andrew Sean Greer. It's a fictional tale about a gay writer called Arthur Less, who's approaching 50 and decides to take a round-the-world trip to distract himself from an ex-boyfriend getting married. It semi-falls into my favourite category of literature I like to call aging person looks back on their life with wisdom and a degree of regret. It is an utter delight of a book. I shared a passage of it on Twitter and there was such an outpouring of love for it from people online. I'm yet to meet someone who's read it and didn't totally fall in love with it and I really think you'd love it. It's incredibly funny, utterly charming and absolutely chock-a-block with warmth. It really sneaks in the most exquisite poignance, particularly on the subject of aging and the passage of time. It's a romantic comedy, and the love and the longing in it is heartbreaking as well as heartwarming. It's just the most human book with a fantastically assured narrator and timeline. It quite rightly won the Pulitzer last year. And the cover and the premise of it make it seem quite light, but the prose is mind-bendingly accomplished. It's the sort of writing that, as a writer, leaves you in awe and reverence, and also, in the interest of full disclosure, total intimidation and massive envy. So I urge you to read that. It's a perfect holiday read.
Poolside read.
Poolside read.
Loved and loathed expression of mine.
A Ryanair read. I was sobbing on the Ryanair back home reading the final chapter. I loved Catelyn Moran's column this weekend on how not to slut-shame your daughters. She talks about the fact that she is on a book tour at the moment and inevitably at the end of every show, she throws it to the audience to ask questions. And she said there's always an exasperated mother who will ask for advice about how to encourage their daughter to discover and celebrate her sexuality while keeping her safe and ensuring that she's not simply defined by her sexuality. And she talks in the piece about how confusing a task it is as a modern feminist mother who is anti-slut-shaming to put that into practice alongside responsible parenting.
I can completely imagine. My daughter is obviously, I don't need to worry about slut-shaming Sadie yet, but the things that you think sort of metaphorically about raising girls, putting it into practice is, you know, it's you've got that kind of motherly instinct that I think could take over what your like sociological feelings are,
or even political, because young women now, and I think this is so exciting, definitely more than our generation when we were teenagers, I think a lot of them are trying to kind of subvert the gaze and politicize their sexuality and take it into their own hands and make it an autonomous thing. And I think that that's very difficult to argue with when someone is being thoughtful about their sexuality, but they still are being so visible with it. So that she talks about one mother who says that she found a picture that her daughter had posted online of her topless with police tape, caution tape, covering her nipples. And her mother said, why have you done that? And she said, it's a political statement on how the female body is so often a crime scene. And apparently this mother was like, well, yeah, that's true. Do you know what I mean? Like, how do I argue with that? And in a political progressive mind, that all makes total sense. But I equally understand, I can imagine, in a maternal sense, you would worry about how vulnerable that would make her. So I think it's a really difficult thing to navigate. And as always, with Catlin Moran and her writing, her ruminations on the subject were incredibly thoughtful and progressive and funny. I'd like to quote the last segment of the column that I particularly loved. And just say for the following quote, these are the pronouns that Catlin used in the piece. In the end, I found my salvation in RuPaul's Drag Race. Drag is the gamification of femininity. It shows men constructing the signifiers of womanhood using padding, makeup, glitter, and shoes. Watching it with teenage daughters is instructive. When a girl child transitions into being a woman, so much of what she is doing is essentially dragging up. And how RuPaul herself, the drag mother, deals with her baby drag queens is incredibly constructive. She loves all her girls, she is supportive and nurturing, but she also knows she has to train them to deal with a world that will be hostile and judgmental. She knows she has to toughen them up. And so, in recent years, my mothering style has become, essentially, that of a bitchy door queen at a gay nightclub, rigorously testing jejune punters in the queue with sassy bants to see if they can handle the world within. Upon my daughters clip-clopping downstairs in some burlesque rig-out cut up to here, I will look at them over an imaginary clipboard and say, "All right, Tits McGee, where are you going in those fuck-me shoes?" If they shout, "Oh, why are you so horrible, Mum?" and run up to their bedroom to cry, they are not yet ready to handle the outside world. But if 6 months later they clip-clop down the stairs and I say, "All right, Tits McGee, where are you going in those fuck-me shoes?" and they reply, "To pick up my diploma from the University of Kiss My Ass," then I know it is safe for them to fly off into the world as the fully formed, sexual, strong, feminist butterflies they have become.
I absolutely love that.
Isn't that lovely?
I think we could all do with picking up a diploma from the University of Kiss My Ass.
I certainly could. I adored Megan Nolan's column for The New Statesman this week, in which she reflects, age 29, on her teenage relationships with older men, with more rather than less confusion. It's such a powerful piece of journalism, and one that in today's editorial landscape is quite hard to come across, in that it dares to sit in the murky unknown and the complicated hypocrisies of the author's personal experiences. I know I often feel a temptation when I'm writing about a very complicated subject to gloss over the conflicts I feel about it and give a kind of fraudulent simplification of my thoughts to seem like I've won the moral maze, which is why, quite frankly, I'm often too scared now to write about complicated subjects. It shouldn't be so bold when a writer comfortably and confidently reflects on something without fear of that kind of moral mob. But it really is, and it's so refreshing. Megan Nolan consistently does that with such intelligence and integrity, and I'm really, really into her writing for that reason. She's also very funny on Twitter. You can follow her at Megan Nolan, with two M's at the beginning of Megan and two N's at the beginning of Nolan. Here is a passage from the piece. What is clear now at 29 is that the very idea of becoming romantically involved with a teenager myself is farcical. How would I speak to one with earnest intimacy? How would I inquire after their exams without bursting into laughter at the absurdity of it all? How could I let their bright and shiny brand newness rub up against my years? When I see beautiful 17-year-olds now, it's not as though I'm ignorant of how one could be attracted to them. I can see their beauty and charisma as well as anyone. Maybe even see it more clearly than those older people who seek out relationships with them, because I can't imagine sullying it with my cynicism and beer gut and eye bags. But then I remember that when I was that beautiful teenager, I wanted it to happen, all of it, every time, with every older man who wanted me. I wore men down when they regretted starting a flirtation. I spoke articulately and affectionately about how I was more mature than my years, how it was different for us, how I was special, we were special. I did all the things that make it my fault. It's quite profound self-reflection, totally without mawkishness or self-pity, which I really love. Her final paragraph is a radically honest one and is very self-aware and articulates a fear that so many women I know who were kind of self-styled former ingenues feel as they get into their 30s and beyond. And I'm so grateful for her for being bold enough to contemplate it out loud and so eloquently. I fear that the accumulation of knowledge and self-definition and the gaining of weight has made me less, not more, desirable. Bound up in all these memories is the sense of how physically small I was, how easily picked up and tossed around and hidden away, how they must have enjoyed my barely there-ness. Today I feel the grief of knowing my solid, ordinary, safe body will never give anyone that pleasure again, and I fear that I will never be desired as I was when I wasn't old enough to comprehend it in any meaningful way.
Well, that's really interesting.
I just really applaud her for being unafraid to look at the kind of nuances of that subject and of her own personal experience. You know, she's allowed to have those thoughts about her own personal history.
Totally.
What have you been enjoying, Sweet Panda?
I gobbled Lem Sissé's My Name Is Why on your suggestion last week, Dolly.
I'm so pleased.
I agree, it took my breath away. I wanted to recommend an interview that he did with Kate Kellaway for The Guardian in 2016 for anyone, and maybe you yourself, Dolly, who read the book and then wanted to know more, like what happened next. Mm. Did he find his birth mother? Did he find his birth father? Did he see, you know, his foster parents again? This interview goes some way to filling in the next part of Lem's story. I will link that in the show notes. I absolutely loved Dawn O'Porter's new book of contemporary female fiction. I'm really not into the term chick lit. It feels really reductive. Mm-hmm. So I have decided to take the very long contemporary female fiction instead, which is what I believe you're writing right now, contemporary female fiction.
Yes.
Would you be happy in my new genre? It's called So Lucky. So for anyone who loved The Cows, which was Dawn's first adult rather than YA novel, I think this is even better. It's about assuming that everyone else has something better than we have or something that makes them somehow luckier. And it's extremely pertinent for these appearance-obsessed presenteeism times. I also thought it was quite a clever title because the word lucky is used a lot now. You know, people say you're so lucky, and often that word kind of really does a disservice to the work that's gone into that person being in that place. It's out in October 2019 and you can pre-order it now. I was utterly wowed by the Turkish-British writer Elif Shafak's new novel 10 Minutes and 38 Seconds in This Strange World, about a murdered woman named Leyla who remains conscious for 10 minutes and 38 seconds after she dies, and in this time she tracks over her entire life from her birth in the Turkish city of Van in the late 1940s to her death in Istanbul in 1990. Her idyllic childhood, which turns sour after her once liberal father becomes a religious fanatic, the sexual abuse inflicted by her uncle forcing her to flee to Istanbul, being sold into prostitution as a teenager, marrying her communist sweetheart, and finding her bunch of five friends who land up in Istanbul after difficult journeys of their own. And we learn their stories too. This makes it sound like a sad book, but it's actually really not. It's incredibly sensuous and poetic and evocative. Leyla's memories all begin, so she tracks it kind of minute by minute, and Leyla's memories all begin with a taste or smell in the minutes after she dies. So the lemon and sugar that her mother and aunt used to wax their legs, her cardamom coffee that she drank twice a day at the brothel. I bought this book after reading a piece by Elif in The Guardian. I think it was the weekend before last. I will link that in the show notes as well as the book. But to be honest, I'm staggered that I'd never read anything by her before, although I had heard of her in a sort of tangential way. She is a hugely well-regarded activist and author. This is her 17th book, her 9th novel in English. Hanif Qureshi, who incidentally has a very enjoyable snappy essay in The New Yorker this week for any fans of The Buddha of Suburbia, calls her one of the most important writers in the world today. She's an incredibly outspoken critic of Turkey. She was put on trial in 2006 for insulting Turkishness. And most recently, her publisher was raided as the police took copies of all of her books to investigate her crimes of obscenity.
Oh my God.
Elif's piece for The Guardian concerns the restrictions of Turkey on the publishing industry. I knew, put really simplistically, that Erdogan was bad news for journalists. He's chucked a lot of them in prison. Masses of scholars have been forced to resign or flee. But I didn't realise until I read this piece how dire the freedom of speech is in Turkey. Since the attempted coup in 2016, 29 publishing houses have been closed in Turkey and 135,000 books have been banned from libraries. I'm now gearing up to read a lot more by this author. Next on my list is another acclaimed book of hers, The Bastard of Istanbul. And I plan to listen to both of her acclaimed TED Talks on the politics of fiction and the revolutionary power of diverse thought, which both have had millions of views.
What an impressive woman.
You know, we often say this, Dolly, of like, how have I not heard of this person? Or how have I not read this? And I had one of these real moments, but like a delighted moment because now I get to read everything else she's written.
Yeah.
And I finally read what is considered the first and one of the most seminal celebrity profiles, Frank Sinatra Has Got a Cold.
I've got to read this, not just because it's the first seminal celebrity profile, but because I love Frank Sinatra.
You absolutely have to read it. It was written for the April 1966 edition of US Esquire, which was one of the most important magazines of the day. Anyone who's read Swan Song or is familiar with Truman Capote we'll remember that he wrote for Esquire too at a similar time. In 1965, Talese, who was now in his late 80s, was in his early 30s, and for his first commission for Esquire, he had been assigned to profile Sinatra. But Sinatra, aged 50, suffering from a cold, moody, fractious and bored of the inquisitions about his relationship with 20-year-old Mia Farrow, was out of sorts and didn't want to be interviewed. So Talese stayed in LA and spoke to the people all around him, turned up at places where he and his people would patronise for what turned into months, and he turned out a very funny, sharp and unbelievably thorough profile. It's 15,000 words.
Oh, I cannot wait to read this.
About so much more than Sinatra. I wanted to read a bit that I really enjoyed him. Sinatra with a cold is Picasso without paint, Ferrari without fuel, only worse. For the common cold robs Sinatra of that uninsurable jewel, his voice, cutting into the core of his confidence. And it affects not only his own psyche, but also seems to cause a kind of psychosomatic nasal drip within dozens of people who work for him, drink with him, love him, depend on him for their own welfare and stability. A Sinatra with a cold can, in a small way, send vibrations through the entertainment industry and beyond, as surely as a president of the United States, suddenly sick, can shake the national economy.
God, that's delicious. Yeah, where did you read it?
You can read it online. It's on Esquire.
Reading that this afternoon.
And lastly, a podcast that I've been meaning to check out for a long time after it won the Podcast of the Year award at the British Podcast Awards and did not disappoint. George the Poet's podcast called Have You Heard George's Podcast? An 8-part series released last year. George Mpanga is a spoken word poet who I'm dying to hear live, and his podcast is a mix of politics, poetry, news, philosophy and music. It's almost impossible to summarise, so I implore you to check it out, and I'm going to insert a clip here so you can get a taster. It's from the first episode, and I think it shows that it's a podcast that is going to get you thinking and the power of words straight away.
People get uncomfortable when you talk about children like that. Like there's a cause and effect relationship between the things we say aloud and the way the future pans out. Like these negative prospects are less likely for our children if we don't acknowledge the current reality. Maybe words really are that powerful. Or maybe that's just a story we tell ourselves to imagine power into existence. Everything you know is a story, an idea that you've accepted until the day you cross it out and replace it with a better answer.
On the subject of recommendations, I also want to just quickly address something here. I'm getting a lot of emails to my personal account asking me to review certain work on the podcast, and I just wanted to sort of reply all here and gently remind that our recommendations are completely organic. There's nothing here that we've been told to talk about, even with author specials. We have to keep really clear on that, especially in these blurred times. In fact, the High Low is a space of total transparency when it comes to that. If there's ever an ad, you'll know it because we thank a brand for their support, financial support, which helps this podcast happen. But there's no product placement, no nods to certain publications or events to curry favour. Zilch, zero, nada. I'd also like to remind anyone to send their recommendations to the High Low's email, not me personally. That's thehighlowshow@gmail.com, and it's in every single set of show notes so that our fabulous sub-editor Anna can keep track of them all for us. We do often take you up on your recommendations, so thank you so much for sending. Support for the High Low comes from Christie. Christie was founded in 1850 by Henry Christie, inventor of the towel that we know today. Since then, Christie have continued to produce high-quality and long-lasting towels, bed linen, and home accessories, all designed in Manchester.
Mine and Pandora's favourite activity, other than eating copious amounts of salt and vinegar crisps, is reading in bed or in the bath. Not together. We've never done that, but there's always time, I suppose.
Find me a big enough bath.
Christy is here for your bed and bath needs.
Christy bed linens boast high thread counts, unique designs, and are made with the finest cotton. They are also known for their towels, especially the Supreme High Grow range, which gets fluffier after every wash.
I love a fluffy bath sheet.
Very hard to find.
And if you don't believe us, believe Wimbledon, because Christy are also the official towel supplier for the Wimbledon Championships, producing the iconic towels used by the players on centre court.
So join us and Andy Murray in living a Christy life and shop online at christy.co.uk and get 25% off your order at christy.co.uk with the code THEHILO. T's and C's apply.
Thanks very much to Christy.
Instagram is experimenting with removing likes from your images to relieve the pressure of the app. In April, Prince Harry spoke of the danger of chasing the well-documented dopamine hit after his account with his wife Meghan became the fastest to acquire 1 million followers. Instagram is testing the new like-free interface in Ireland, Australia and Japan with the potential to roll out globally. Instagram's Tara Hopkins said, "We want Instagram to be a place where people feel comfortable expressing themselves." Doll, how do you feel about no likeies?
I think it's a great idea. I don't think it will make all our collective problems associated with social media disappear overnight, but it's long been documented that the like function is a particularly poisonous component of social media and is the thing that really aggravates damaging habits and kind of bad spiralling thought processes.
I agree. I think it's a great decision. Think of that phrase, do it for the likes. Mm. People posting a picture that they think will perform well and then refreshing to see what sort of validation that picture has got is insidious. It's damaging, and it's meant that for half a decade or whatever it is, the idea of liking someone doesn't actually mean like at all. It's a flimsy sense of digital approval that you can build your own self-worth on, and you can in fact like someone that you dislike. This isn't just something teenagers suffer from, I hasten to add. Grown adults do too, and it's also not just a female problem. It's about feeling included in your community, your society, and all of us seek approval from the world we live in. So I don't think it's silly if you feel this way on social media.
Yeah, it's totally normalised as well. It's a shared problem. And beyond that, I think it really stunts any sense of authenticity or creativity or identity. I know I felt for a while that that like button was like I was disconnecting from my own taste and instinct. And that's a really precious thing as humans that we build from childhood.
I would, however, like to add, I don't believe that Instagram really cares about how comfortable people are. The app is Facebook-owned, and the ex-president of Facebook, Sean Parker, admitted in 2017 that not only did they know that the like button could exploit human vulnerability for profit, but they specifically designed the app to do that, and lots of other software developers who were with Facebook or in Silicon Valley at the genesis of social media have said exactly the same thing. So, no, I don't see these changes as a kindness. I see this as a business decision, damage limitation, a way to pivot away from criticism and rising pressure from people regarding mental health.
That's exactly what it is. I couldn't agree more.
One thing I did think was interesting is that if you so choose, you'll still be able to see your own likes. And so I do think that you'll still see people chasing that sense of approval, even if other people can't see it. What do you think?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, it might quell the desire for a sense of social public status, but it definitely would build towards that private sense of flimsy self-worth that you described.
A lot has been written about how this will mean the death of influencer culture, which has been seen to be spiralling out of control in the last year, with the ASA increasingly clamping down on ads. Brands won't be able to see how well their collaborations with individuals are performing, which is known as engagement. I read a really informative article on a website called The Conversation about this. Without having ready and easy numbers to assess performance and justify expenditure, the removal of the like counter may deprive businesses of some much-needed market intelligence. On the other hand, the removal of these high like scores may also function to restore the more socially collaborative rather than competitive nature of social media. A potentially significant advantage in removing these counters is that it may reduce the revenue stream of click farms, whose whole purpose seems ethically dubious and whose labour conditions are not always fair. I think that's really interesting because you can buy followers, you can buy clicks, there's a lot of kind of buying of those likes you can do. Those operations will likely still prosper by producing fake followers as long as those counters are still visible. Also, you'll still be able to see, as a brand, you'll still be able to see how many followers an individual has. So it's not like all barometers of reach are removed. I do wonder if you'll now see a chase for... Well, you've always seen a chase for followers as much as you have the likes. So, you know, this is not like a total overhaul of social media.
I also think that's a good thing. I was talking recently with a friend who works with brands and works with marketing brands. And she says she really does think that brand strategy is getting really lazy and lacking ingenuity off the back of this likes converting to sales model through influencer culture.
An influencer from New Zealand called Michaela Tester posted a video of her breaking down after receiving the news about Instagram. If you think this is okay, you can fuck off. It's actually a sad day for those who have Instagram as a job, she wrote to her followers on Facebook. Regardless of what you may think, Instagram is a real job, and those in the industry have worked hard to get where they're at. It's people that aren't even in the industry that think it's a fucking joke. It's not. It's real damage out here. I've put my blood, sweat and tears into this for it to be ripped away. It's not just me suffering. It's every brand and business I know. Instagram isn't even doing this for mental health. They're doing it so they can control all engagement, so more businesses run their adverts through Instagram, essentially giving them more dollars. They don't care about your feelings. I think a lot of people would sneer at Michaela's emotional video, but I think feeling like you're losing your livelihood, whatever livelihood, is really scary.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about that statement. I understand how scary it must be for your livelihood to be taken away, and my sympathies go out to her for that, but I do think we need to re-examine what blood, sweat and tears are. Do you think that sounds sneery?
No, I think most people would agree with you. I suppose I always worry about feeding into the rhetoric that, like, the visual presentation of something or digital media is very, like, done. You know? Yeah. I feel like sometimes people have thought that the podcast doesn't take very long to put together. And so I imagine... You know, when people look at Instagram and think, oh, well, that's not a job.
No, but you're literally asking people to be on holiday or wear things and take pictures of them. I'm not judging
it.
I'm not judging it as a career choice. The reason I'm being quite outspoken about this is I was talking about this with my friends last week. And I think the problem is I really worry, as someone who has, I'll put my cards on the table, worked with brands and been in paid partnerships, I worry that the notion of creation and work ethic is very, very diluted by doing that. I have done that. Not masses of it. I've done a little bit of it. And I've done all my other various work that I've done. And they're very different things. They're very, very different things.
I think that also feeds into what we've seen, which is the kind of bastardization of the words like creator and curator. And what we think of as being creative. I've done paid partnerships, I've worked with brands. It's not something that's part of my life at the moment, but I agree it's a very different level of creation and also of time.
And I think what worries me is my friend who I was talking to last week, who's been a secondary school teacher for 10 years, has said she's astonished now at the majority of children who, when you ask them what they want to be when they're a grown-up, they say an influencer.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
And that in itself is not an issue, but what I worry about is that the notion of process and graft is slightly eliminated and becomes defunct when the option is there to make masses of money from taking pictures of yourself having a good time. Do you see what I mean? I'm trying really hard not to sound judgmental and sneery here. If you'd said to me, aged 15, right, you'd like to be a writer, would you like to go to university, get a certain mark in a degree, which means you could do a journalism master's, then move home and live with your parents in the suburbs and do unpaid internships during the day and then go pound the streets of London at night as a promo girl, giving out flyers for £7 an hour so that you can fund yourself and then maybe get a byline 2 to 3 years after that? Or would you like to be paid £10,000 to wear a dress? Yeah, I'll take the second, please.
I would say that you have to work very hard to get to a position where your profit model is earning you £10,000 to wear the dress.
Very, very true.
But what I would say is what you're saying is this problem that we have in life, which is this complete lack of delayed gratification. We get food on demand, we get clothes on demand, we get an entire series on demand. So what you do have, I think, is a lot of young people, not all, but a lot of young people who want that career within like a year or whatever. You know, they look at Love Island and they see, you're not going to understand this story, but I'm going to run with it. They see Molly Mae Hague, who's 20 years old and has almost 1 million followers on Instagram, you know, as an influencer with perfect veneered teeth and hair extensions. And I'm veering a little bit off topic here, but it all feeds into the same thing. And you know what? It is problematic, and it's something that I have been complicit in. You know, the reason why I don't do partnerships at the moment, the reason why I don't really post many pictures of myself, is because I was profiting from something that I was really unsure how I felt about. Yeah. And I also felt like it was really distracting from the work I was doing.
Yeah.
I was constantly referred to as an influencer rather than a journalist and a podcast creator and a writer, which is what I have done before I used Instagram and the other 23 hours that Kayla wrote asleep.
But it's always been your full-time job.
It's always been my full-time job. And it started to be the only job people saw and the only thing people would talk about. And I can remember a very sad moment for me is when my brother congratulated me on hitting 200,000 followers on Instagram. And I just thought, something is wrong. Yeah. I am doing something wrong for me.
Yeah.
So I understand, you know, both of us, I know, are so conscious of not, like, dissing how other people make money. I think it's something to be like applauded when someone is creative with the platforms we have in this world.
And it, as you say, it does take strategy and thought and intelligence. I'm not diminishing that at all.
But I think we're allowed to be skeptical and we're allowed to be analytical, and especially given that it's something we've been complicit in.
Totally. And especially the fact that for all of us and our long-term job security, it is going to implode.
Yeah.
This is not safe to be investing in forever.
Yeah, my mum said to me the other day, how would you feel if Instagram just broke? I was like, I feel absolutely fine, mum. Like, you know, that there's nothing on that I wouldn't still retain.
Just broke.
My life, my pictures. Quite a few people have pointed out that this will hopefully mean a decrease in how homogenous pictures are. Basically, the basicness of a millennial pink wall, avocado toast, swan pool inflatables. As people will stop memeifying other people's content that has performed well. I think it'd be really interesting to see how a platform that originally created individuality and spontaneity and then became incredibly controlled, curated and repetitive either returns to its origins or finds a totally new digital form.
Yeah, it's really interesting. My photographer friend, Chris, who also listens to the podcast, say hello, Chris.
Hello, Chris.
Said to me once that there's a certain type of person that he sees. Normally he works in fashion, who, if you were to put them in an isolated cell for 6 months, completely cut off from the world and its trends, and then when they emerged, if you asked them what they liked, they understandably would have no idea.
Yeah, that's a definite breed of person in fashion, I agree.
And I wonder if this removal of the like button may have that same kind of disorientating effect on a certain type of person for whom what they like for the last however many years. I mean, I've been on Instagram for
seven years.
Yeah. And I'm probably guilty of doing this as well. If what you like is only visible in reference to what everyone else likes, once the like feature goes, that could be a real mindfuck for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think a lot of people will find this news scary, also just because change is scary. Mm. Does this signal the death knell for social media, though? Lots of Gen Z are not interested in Instagram, etc. anyway, and they're certainly not interested in Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, we keep reading statistics that they're moving away from it. Instagram, as we know it, certainly is not sustainable. So I think maybe this is just the first turn of the dial, of which there will be many.
What I hope this does is remind people that social media is a reflection of what you have achieved or who you are, not the sum total of your achievements and yourself. I do worry about a personal profit model which is entirely dependent on a digital platform. And I think it should be part of your skill set. So perhaps you're also a presenter or a model or a poet or a craftsperson or a cook or a designer or a netball teacher. Just not the entire skill set. And then for the people who aren't influencers, the regular people who suffer from lifestyle envy or comparisonitis or feelings of inadequacy, this could be a reminder that your Instagram account or any digital account is not your own. It belongs to a company. It's at the behest of their whims. It's ephemeral and transient, and we have no control over it.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This week, the journalist Laura Snapes pointed me in the direction of an utterly brilliant article that I haven't been able to stop thinking about. It's written by Susanna Schauler for BuzzFeed and is titled, Why Are We Obsessed With Other People's Daily Habits? In it, the writer describes how she was granted a year off via a fellowship to fill with creating her own work. She moved somewhere remote with her partner and became utterly obsessed with finding the perfect habits and the perfect formation of a day to optimise her creativity. She describes how she recipe tested certain types of days. She inhaled essential oil mists, drew pictures of her plants. She sewed a fleece blanket into a writing cape with an enormous periphery swallowing hood. She also studied the book by Mason Curry, Daily Rituals. Have you read this book, Panda?
Never heard of it.
So I must confess, I read it years ago and I loved it. It's a book that details the habits of our most celebrated creators, from their eating patterns while they were working to their sleeping habits to their sex habits. Basically, it's a kind of archive of creative process. The piece references it and its new edition, which focuses just on the work habits of female creators and uses it as a springboard into an investigation on why these tidbits are so addictive and fascinating to us. I should be upfront from the beginning and say I am an absolute sucker for hearing about the details of people's daily habits. I want to know how people write, where they write, when they write, what they eat when they write, if and how they break up their writing. I'm utterly, utterly obsessed. Is it something that interests you?
Yes, I really want to read that book now. And we are not alone, Dolly. Look at the success of New York Magazine website, The Cuts, How I Get It Done segment, which, incidentally, I have interviewed people for before. So I'm contributing to the process. I became obsessed, and not in an entirely positive way, with Audrey Gelman's one, where she revealed that her assistant and her have 60 different colour-coded categories for her emails. God. It made my email sorting system feel a bit insubstantial.
Well, do you remember when we played the clip of Adam Buxton talking about Mark Wahlberg's daily routine, where he got up at something like 3 a.m.
I didn't feel insubstantial reading that, though. I actually rather rudely thought, what a depressing life.
Yeah,
what
it can't have been true.
What a completely self-orientated life. And also, at the end of the day, hadn't really done anything except moved his body parts and filled them with food.
None of it made any sense, if you remember, because it was like 2 hours of prayer, but then half an hour of mini golf.
Yeah, it was indulgent. There are also entire websites dedicated to beauty routines. That's a very popular one. Think of all those YouTube videos as well, like Into the Gloss. Again, I've shared my beauty routine there and I really enjoyed it, even though I know zilch about beauty.
I loved reading that.
Never written about it. But I enjoyed sharing products in the same way I enjoy sharing my reading recommendations, because I love recommending stuff. I am also unbelievably nosy, and I'm always curious about the way other people live their lives. When I was little, my mum and my favourite thing to do when we were driving somewhere is if someone had left their front door open and we could see the whole way in, down the hallway through to the kitchen. I even like the inside my fridge column in frigging Closer magazine.
I love that feature.
I can't imagine you reading Closer magazine. I spend ages studying the styling of the products in the fridge, like where the broccoli is, where the salmon is, and wondering if they employ a full-time food stylist for that column, or if it's like one day a week job. Also, people lie because they always eat the most unbelievably healthy. It's always a salmon stir fry.
12 almonds as a snack.
A sweet potato with, you know, a pea. And then at the end, some nutritionist gives them fucking 7 out of 10.
I know.
God, I'm not sharing my food diary anytime soon.
What this piece really made me think about is how much money I've spent trying to emulate the habits of great artists.
And I just love the idea of you buying like an easel so you could think like Picasso. Wearing a beret so that you could, I don't know, be like Flaubert.
whether it's buying a special ergonomic laptop stand or buying trainers for a morning run or a coffee machine or flowers for my desk or a radio to play classic FM on, because I heard that, you know, that's what gets your mind working.
Do try Spotify for that, doll. So it's an online streaming platform.
But it's weird how I do keep thinking that through these purchases or these new habits, I will find the back door finally into my genius.
The back door into your genius?
Yeah, I'll find the back somewhere. There's genius somewhere and I've just got to find
the
secret.
Can you help Dolly find her back door? She's got to find a secret entrance. Oh my God, it gets even dirtier. Pandora.
But when you think about what it's for as well, it's just for creating work that generates money. And this is one of the main thrusts of the piece, examining how the fetishization of creative habits plus an anxious and kind of insecure collective modern psyche that's obsessed with our own kind of inadequacy and lack of productivity, how that all has aligned with capitalism.
This really is not a dissimilar thought process to the segment that we've just done. They interlink very nicely.
Here's a particularly insightful quote on the subject from the piece. The elevation of our habits to sacred acts aims to reappraise what counts as time meaningfully spent. But valuing every part of your life as part of a process is a holistic act only if you can actually decouple it from how you measure and value the result, whether that's a hand-knit sweater, an essay, or a line of code. How many of us can really do that? Can we afford to? Where would we start? As long as everything we do is potentially monetizable, from our creative hobbies to our social influence to the data we generate by performing basic tasks online, I'm not sure it will ever be possible. Much in the same way that the fetish for wellness swallows and camouflages the desire to be thin. Maybe getting in touch with your most authentic creative self is at some base level still about increasing productivity and status. Which forces me towards some unpleasant questions. Is real creativity even possible under capitalism? Does worshipping at a creative altar just mean finding new ways to win?
110%. It's all about the pursuit of happiness, the idea that someone else holds the key to unlocking the best life or your best life. Capitalism has led us to believe that everything is profitable, including our own selves.
Another thread of the piece that I found very persuasive is how often the fundamental thing that gives creators time to cultivate a technicolor array of writerly habits is missing when we have these discussions, which is, of course, money and appropriate support.
To spend any time on the process rather than on the work or in studying other people's processes is like an indulgent, you know, it requires some external funding.
As is the creative work itself. When discussing the Mason Curry book, Susanna writes, many of these artists never really made a living from their work, and more often than not, their idiosyncratic routines were directly sustained by the labour of spouses and servants afforded by independent wealth or both. Flaubert lay in bed all morning being tended to by domestic help and pounding on the wall when he felt like having a chat with his mummy. Freud's wife Martha did everything for him, right down to squeezing his toothpaste onto the brush. Likewise, those without the resources to hold themselves apart from the grinding demands of survival often suffered for it in direct and striking ways, both in their work and often in their health. None of which is new information, just hard to miss when you inhale a dozen descriptions of different variations on cocktail hour in a row.
Oh my God, I'm obsessed with that line about Flaubert, banged on the wall when he felt like chatting with mummy. Also, and this is something that I think whenever I read a daily routine, like the Sunday Times magazine does a brilliant one at the back, or when I read a food diary, I do think confusedly, but do you eat that every day or do you do that every day? Because when people share their routines, because it's kind of impossible to do otherwise, they're sharing just one day and they're most likely sharing their most productive day or their most interesting day or their healthiest day.
I think the transparency thing is the part of the piece that really made me think the most. For so long, I've been so fascinated with the kind of correct formula to harbour creative freedom that will allow me to write to the absolute best of my ability, when really I know what that freedom is, and it's money. When I think back on the first book proposal that I wrote, I was 25. I was working full-time in TV on rolling contracts with zero security built into them. And in between contracts, I asked my bosses if I could take a month off work to try and kind of tackle a book proposal. And I'd spent 6 months saving so I'd be able to pay my rent and make sure that I could eat for 4 weeks. And I wrote 50,000 words in that time. And there was no room at all for cultivating kind of interesting creative habits other than just writing the book during the day and doing freelance journalism at night to give me a kind of token salary from that month. I just had to write out of sheer fucking fear. I had no other choice. And then 5 years later, age 30, I look at how I wrote my second proposal a few months ago, and I took 3 days off work, left London, went away for a few days and wrote it all. I could afford to not be checking my emails during that time. I could afford to have a week not working on various ongoing projects. I could afford peace and quiet and isolation or a nice coffee when I wanted a coffee break. And I wrote the first three chapters and synopsis in a very short space of time. And truly, I think the main reason it was so different to the first time that I tried to tackle a book proposal was that I just had a bit of savings for the first time in my life. And it just meant that I could totally throw myself into those pages with zero other distractions or fear. Because let's not forget that fear, I really have noticed in the last 10 years, fear and practical worries is the thing that gets in the way most of creative process. And when that was lifted from me just for a few days, I could just throw myself into writing and think about nothing else. And that is such a privilege. And I'm really not saying that to be smug or to congratulate myself. I'm saying it because I think it's so important to be transparent about how a degree of security is so impactful on creative process. It's totally not impossible to do without it, but it is much, much harder.
Yeah, I mean, I recently wanged on about the Pomodoro technique, which I was trying out.
Totally. Oh yeah,
forgotten about that.
How did that go?
Well, forgot about it completely. Now I'm just back to trying to write for as long as possible without petering out, and that is incidentally less hours than I thought possible. So I'm just trying to make my peace with that. But you're right, you know, I too have the financial freedom right now to not have to write my book at night while my baby sleeps. I get to make it a part of my working day, like the high-low.
Susanna also examines this by detailing a talk she attended with Zadie Smith. She said, "I once attended a Q&A where novelist Zadie Smith addressed a room full of grad students in the humanities and fine arts. The audience was small enough to feel like we were getting to see something up close, too large to really be intimate. Of course, someone asked the usual questions about art and life, art and parenting, art and work. How does it all fit together? How do you do it? What's your advice? Have money," Smith said. The room laughed like this was a clever joke, but she wasn't being glib, just real. I felt like I'd been slapped. Her answer was so simple and honest, it might have been mistaken for confession, with a tone not totally undemanding. It lingered near my solar plexus for days. Zadie Smith hadn't made time to work, she'd bought it. That truth was a far more valuable gift to me than even the most appealing, elegant, mystical enunciation of her daily routine. Smith was willing to offer herself up as a model only of the privilege success affords, and in doing so she might have been revealing a broader truth, that no one's life is a model for anything but themselves."
This piece is so beautifully written, and I think also really elucidates the way in which BuzzFeed has grown from the platform it used to be to host like
serious long-form journalism.
Seriously poetic writing as well. There's a great interview with Zadie Smith in The Telegraph in 2002 when she was just 26, where she talks about this. She talks about having money. She's ruthlessly honest and the opposite of vainglorious. She also talks about how she got laid a lot at Cambridge. It's a really good interview. But she's totally unapologetic about the money that she's made and what that's afforded her. "The best bit is buying books," she says. "I eat out all the time. I get cabs everywhere. I drink fresh orange juice with everything." She had just bought a flat in Kilburn after the success of White Teeth. "I may have been working class once, but I think once you live in a nice flat and a nice area and you've had a great education, you're really pushing it to claim to be salt of the earth. Life changes."
I think Zadie Smith is a really interesting subject when we're talking about this, because she really is the kind of bastion of sort of habit fetishism, I think.
The bastion of habit fetishism. This might be your best work yet, this segment.
Very convoluted. But she is, in a way, I think. Every writer I know is always longing to be more like Zadie Smith, who's so kind true. Of famously tech-phobic. She doesn't have a smartphone. Only very small portions of her working schedule are dedicated to the internet and email. And reading this piece really crystallised for me how absurd it is to try to copy her habits in order to replicate her work ethic or success or genius. Zadie Smith was a pre-internet author. By the time social media came into play, she had already written something like 4 books, 1 awards, and was an established bestseller and kind of literary voice of our time. Of course, Zadie Smith doesn't need to be on Twitter and checking her emails all day. Of course, she doesn't have to do some campaign with a bookshop on Instagram or Twitter. The internet is so key for publishing campaigns, and there is so much work and time and creativity that goes into them. To try and remove yourself completely from it in order to somehow capture some of Zadie Smith's magical process, which, as the author says of this piece, only ever makes sense in conjunction with that person, their personality, their history, their life, their career. None of it makes any sense.
Also, not having a smartphone won't make you Zadie Smith.
Yeah.
But I think it's very interesting that she is the bastion of habit fetishism, because more broadly speaking, what she is as a woman who is totally unapologetic about who she is and completely confident in who she is. And that comes through in her work, in her written interviews, in her live events, in her podcast interviews. She is absolutely sure in her own skin, or at least comes across like that. I think that people are trying to replicate her process. I cannot say that in an English accent. But not just because of the work she's produced, but because they're like, God, I want to be that sure of myself.
Yeah.
I want to be that confident. And the irony is that she isn't looking at anyone else's process. So, you know, that tells us something, doesn't it? Another great interview, by the way, with Zadie Smith is her one with Touré, where she talks about not writing for invisible applause. We've mentioned that before on the podcast, but I will link that in the show nizzles as well. Ultimately, I think that focusing on someone else's routines and habits is yet another way to try and create who we think we should be. If you find inspiration in someone else's life, if they suggest a book or a meditation app or a clothing brand or a moisturizer or a foodstuff or a school that works for you and your family, that's brilliant. I believe in sharing that kind of stuff. But where it gets pernicious, and again, this is very linked to the first segment, the first topic that we did in today's show, is when you build on that so that a great recommendation is not just a great recommendation, but a way to create a new life or escape your own life or any other grand aspiration like that. Improve, possibly. Escape, no.
I wanted to end on the author's final paragraph of the piece, in which she reflects on the cult of individualism that also plays into this idea of being kind of precious about process, and that we mustn't forget how incredibly important connection is when it comes to work, as well as contentment and well-being and kind of solid mental health. My year of freedom came and went. The jury's still out on whether I made the most of it. One might notice the failed book proposal, the unimpressive word count, the fact that I was diagnosably lonely and ridiculous. But the real failure was obviously this. Everything in my life was designed to serve an aesthetic purpose rather than an ethical one. I was chasing the shadow of a shadow, serving only myself, worse, an idea of myself. I wasn't making myself responsible to any other human being. That's no way to live, and I don't plan to make a habit of it.
What a payoff. Process! Thank you very much for listening to The High Low. You can rate, review and subscribe on iTunes. It helps other people find us and helps boost us in the charts. You can email us thehighlowshow@gmail.com. Please remember to email us there, not our personal accounts, so that we can keep track of everything you send our way. You can tweet us at The High Low Show. And if you would like to come and see us live in action, don't forget there are still some tickets available for our Manchester show at faneproductions.com/highlow. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was a very well done ending.
Sainsbury's supermarket in Bath was rebranded last week as Sainsbury's to raise... Sounds like yourself. Sainsbury's.
Sainsbury's.
Was rebranded last week as Sainsbury's.
Like Dick Van Dyke.
To celebrate its 150th birthday, Sainsbury's supermarket in Bath was rebranded last week as Sainsbury's.
Way too big a build-up. It's way too long a sentence.
So I think I just start with...
We start with rebranded.
Okay.
Rebranded at Sainsbury's.
Say it a few times. Sainsbury's.
Sainsbury's?
Sainsbury's, Mary Poppins.